You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, broadcasting from the home of the soon-to-be national champion, Texas Longhorns.
This is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
Hey, our question for episode 14 is something like, what's a philosophically astute approach to political matters? We've read Machiavelli's The Prince and the first 20 chapters or so of his Discourses on Livy. You can find those two texts linked to from partiallyexaminedlife.com. We have some ground rules we've been giving ourselves for these discussions, and I think you guys should remember what the first one is.
We do not assume that our audience knows anything about the subject matter, nor that they have done the reading.
Yes, that's nice. Number two, no gratuitous name dropping. Why, we're interested in ideas, not with fetishizing dead philosophers. Although I think Wes has a Kant blow-up doll or something, right? If we have a point to make, we'll just make it and not say, for instance, you would know what I'm talking about if you had read Francis Diderot's Deux Poupes on a Plate. Number three, we shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except in the case we're not doing so. Seems like it would be awesome. Here we are back after a month off. How was your time?
It's really good. I had a really good holiday. How about you guys?
I got a Kindle. I read Machiavelli on my Kindle.
Yeah, me too.
How did you?
Yes, it's very easy to underline things. I like that.
I'm very hostile to the idea of reading books electronically.
Well, I have been reading books electronically on my phone for the last few months, and that's okay, but you don't get that much of a sense of how much more is there to go in the way that you do in almost any other form. Even though it has like a progress bar, there's so little on any one screen that it's just, this is going forever.
Yeah. I like it on the iPhone, though. And it syncs between the Kindle and the iPhone.
Oh.
Yeah, all your notes sync, all your last place where you were reading, so you can just jump back and forth between the Kindle and the iPhone. I'm very into the whole ebook thing, even though I used to think it would never take off. But why are you opposed to it, Seth?
Aesthetics. I like a book. I like to flip pages. I like reading the printed word. No, that's a good reason.
It doesn't mean you give up book. I mean, you know, obviously you don't entirely give up books. It's just convenient, you know, especially for stuff like, you know, if you have a lot of books and your shelves are full and you're getting like Idiot's Guide to Plumbing or something and you don't want to add that to your bookshelf, then it's good for that. So
I totally get the appeal.
I haven't bought any books like that. I've been just using it for like the, you know, the 99-cent things that are for free if they're just on the internet. Like the Machiavelli stuff that we've been reading. So Seth, are you really saying that every single book that we've read so far here, you've read the paper copy? You have sought out a paper copy?
No. I read the text from the links that you post so that I have a common frame of reference with the audience. But I do not enjoy reading on the computer. I prefer to read out of a book. And reading a book is a way for me to kind of unplug because I'm constantly in front of a screen or constantly with my phone or constantly. And when I can just like sit on the couch and have no music and no television or anything like that and just have a book, it creates an experience for me that's unique and somewhat nostalgic. I just prefer that.
The only thing with the Kindle, I'm just still getting past the, but this is free on the web. Why do I have to pay for it on the Kindle? That's my only complaint so far.
Well, you can put them on manually, too.
Like the New York Times. Like, just looking at the freaking New York Times website on the Kindle, I would like to do that instead of paying a dollar an issue or whatever that they want me to pay.
Yeah, well, you won't be able to get the New York Times for free that much longer.
So, Machiavelli. You want to give us some historical background or something? Wes, maybe?
Yeah.
You're reading some outside things.
So, I was just going to give the typical little summary and with some historical background. So, Machiavelli was born in 1469 in Florence, Italy, and he grew up in during his youth, he lived in the time of the Medicis, who were essentially a family that owned a bank and took over Florence because of their wealth. And that time was relatively stable. But during his adulthood, Italy was basically a mess. It was Spain and France and the Holy Roman Empire were allying with various city-states and coming in and getting kicked out. And so the Domitians actually got kicked out of Florence in 1494, and it became a republic. And that's the year that Machiavelli was given a government post as sort of a low-level, well, eventually he became started out as a clerk or something and quickly became a low-level diplomat. He got that post because his father was a pretty prominent lawyer, and in the sort of humanistic tradition that had developed in Florence at that time, you know, the beginnings of the Renaissance and so forth, they were actually prone to put professors, university professors, into government posts. And Machiavelli wasn't a professor, but he was learned, and his father had connections to intellectual circles, and one of Machiavelli's former teachers was actually working for the government and basically got him a post. That allowed Machiavelli to get a lot of the observations that are the basis for the prince. He, as an envoy, he got to hang out in various courts, Pope Alexander VI, Charles VIII, I think it's Charles VIII, France, Maximilian of the Holy Roman Empire, and Caesar Borgia or Cesare Borgia? Something like that. Cesare Borgia. The Domitians returned in 1512, and he lost that government post, and he was kind of depressed, went to his country estate, and then made the best of it by pursuing his literary career. And that started with The Prince and the Discourses, which we read for this podcast, and he also wrote some plays and poetry. And The Prince actually, it wasn't published until after he was dead. In fact, the only thing that was published while he was alive was The Art of War. I think it was published in 1533 in Venice, and it eventually made a big splash as being, actually, I like Bertrand Russell calls it a handbook for gangsters, but it had a bad reputation early on.
And he wrote under a pseudonym of Sun Tzu, right?
Oh, yeah. Very funny. Shakespeare refers to him, or has Richard III and refer to him as murderous Machiavel, and so on and so forth. So The Prince basically covers what must be done to establish a principality and hold it and maintain it. And Machiavelli is concerned specifically not with a hereditary state, not with a republic, but with a new prince who's just gotten power, and basically gives a lot of maxims. What do you have to do to obtain power? And the thing that made the book famous for its wickedness is basic amorality. There's no appeal to Christian values. Prince is given advice basically to be completely ruthless. And there are famous, we'll discuss all this later, but there some of the famous maxims include, you know, it's better to be feared than loved. It's good to be loved, but if you have to choose between being feared and loved, you choose being feared. On the other hand, you can't be hated by your populace. And there's a lot of things that you do to sort of make sure all of that happens, including everything from awing the populace with your own greatness and your own manliness, or virtu is the word, and then doing other things like avoiding some of the traditional, even classical virtues like liberality, because is it really a virtue if it leads to taxation and pissing the populace off? Above all, you have to keep the populace friendly, don't tax them, don't disarm them, don't establish fortresses which show that you distrust them, and so on and so forth. So some of the themes there are these, like he takes pagan values and puts them on steroids. So he gives up some of the, even Cicero advocated all these magnanimity and avoiding cruelty. But basically, Machiavelli, do whatever you can to maintain the state, even if it requires ruthlessness. Your one objective is to maintain power, which typically involves greatness and glory and doing great things. And most importantly, adapting yourself to the times, being versatile, being bold when necessary, cautious when necessary. And then famously, at the end of it, treating Fortuna as the woman she is and opposing her with violence, and basically not just giving in the traditional Christian sense to a sort of fatalism. Okay, so with the Discourses, we get something seemingly
let's have a little bit of initial back and forth about that characterization.
Okay.
And I know that the article that you had sent us by Isaiah Berlin, I looked at very, very quickly, and so I'm not sure how much of this I'm stealing from that. But yes, the subject of The Prince is chiefly how to obtain and maintain power, but that doesn't mean that that's the sum total of your goal. It's just, this is what this is about. It's a prerequisite to anything else. In fact, it was a prerequisite to having a peaceful state, to having, I shouldn't use the word peaceful because he advocated maintaining power by waging wars and things, but to have a stable government was a prerequisite for pretty much anything good happening among the people at all, right? If you have a constant chaos in your state, then people's everyday lives are going to be terribly disrupted, and that's bad.
Yeah, so
and he argues not just for how good it is to establish institutions that will maintain power after you, the singular ruler that you are, die. So that shows that he's not purely concerned.
That's more in the discourses than in the prince, but. The idea of establishing institutions that outlast the prince has more to do with the republic, I think. I mean, I think, obviously, in some sense, it's instrumental, right? Why do you want to maintain power? You want your state to survive. And then the discourses makes that all clear. The idea is, what's the best way to live? You know, but within realistic boundaries, what do you have to do to establish the best possible state that you can have, let's say, for the good of the people?
Give your intro to the discourses. We can talk about how these two fit together. Yeah, he was writing them at the same time.
The discourses is all about liberty. So whereas the prince is about essentially authoritarian states where a new prince has taken over power, discourses is about a republic where the people have some say over who's the ruler and where liberty is the primary foundation for the effective state. There's some overlap with the prince because liberty involves, for instance, making sure that the populace is armed.
And that you only serve as a prince to some degree. The populace are always going to outnumber you, so you have to give them a say, or have some way for them to vent their anger and things like that, or else you're going to go down.
Yeah. So the question that he's overtly concerned with in the discourses is what made Rome so great? What made it last so long? Again, he's concerned with the foundation of a stable state and the idea that liberty does that better than a prince, than an authoritarian prince, because to go back to something that he mentions in The Prince, the people tend to have certain characters. You know, they might be more cautious. They might be more adventurous, and so they're not so adaptable, whereas the people as a whole are going to be more adaptable to circumstances. So ultimately, the people will make better decisions, they'll keep the state more stable, and the way you make sure that you maintain that stability is by sort of conditioning the people, and good institutions, a good constitution are part of that, a sort of system of checks and balances where the nobility and the people sort of check each other's excesses, and then laws which keep people in line, and then he mentions religion, and then also military expansion. Again, it comes, I think he thinks this idea of virtu and greatness is very important, and the inspiring effect of the state's leader, which involves constant military expansion and prowess and things like that.
Right. So Nietzsche admired Machiavelli quite a bit, and the Isaiah Berlin piece that you had us read gave a picture of Machiavelli's ethical outlook is very similar to Nietzsche's in that he glorifies maybe the ancient Greek and Roman attitudes toward religion and glory and pride and things like that, as opposed to the Christian self-sacrifice sort of virtues, which would just lead you to lose your state if you're a ruler, or let yourself be oppressed if you're not a ruler. I found adding the discourses to this, though, extremely enlightening. I started reading through The Prince and like, okay, I'm kind of familiar with the shtick here. You can look for some subtleties and some, like, what are his attitudes toward the peasantry, toward the different classes, maybe get some insight on history or the specific recommendations that he's making on how to maintain a state. But ultimately, not a lot of that is of philosophical interest to me.
Right, right. Well, he wasn't really a philosopher, which is interesting reading him. But
yeah, both of these really profess to be practical statecraft learning from history.
Mm-hmm.
So the discourses on Livy, just to spell it out, it's discourses on the first 10 books of Titus Livy, who is a historian of Rome. And he uses a lot of references to how the various emperors of Rome, how they were good or bad emperors, but also to popes and people in the modern age. And really in both of these books, he just jumps around to whatever historical instances he can come up with that are useful to him, even to the extent of talking about kings in the Bible, talking about Solomon and David and Moses as being a really effective leader. And so I found it most useful to sort of just read these two as one unit, that together these present a practical guide to how to make things work out in politics. And that ultimately in both situations, yes, in a republic, you're going to have laws that are going to be, the emphasis is not on the individual ruler, but on laws and a stable institution to guarantee continued stability of the state and continued freedom. But in some ways, especially given what kind of government he ends up recommending, it seems that these things just ran together quite a bit for me. I didn't see the style as starkly different as I was expecting.
Weren't you surprised, though? Just the advocacy of liberty, you know, I'd entirely forgotten about that.
Right. And from what you said about his biography, you can see he prospered under a republic and got a job. And then when the plutocrats came back into power, he lost his job.
Some academics will claim that it's a satire. The Prince is a satire. Others will say it was written strictly to try and get in with the back end with the Domitis. But I think, you know, I don't see that. And I don't see anything satirical in The Prince either.
So Seth, what's your background with this? Had you read either of these before?
I'd read The Prince many, many years ago. I'd read some Livy many years ago, but I had not read Discourses on Livy. I guess I started off reading it and trying to say, well, follow your guidance, Mark, and say, you know, what sort of philosophical principles can we abstract from all of the specific examples that he's giving? But I actually found the historical examples to be very interesting. And I agree with Wes that the Prince is actually very earnest. And if you look at that final chapter, there's a sense almost of, I don't want to say despair, but he's clearly extremely upset or disappointed with the state of affairs in Italy at the time.
Which was not a unified country.
Yeah, there was no Italy, I guess, per se. But I think more importantly, the fact that he felt as though Spain and France had undue influence on the country, and that he wanted to see a unified Italy that was ruled by Italians, or at least something like that. The Prince is almost like an appeal for some sort of native, not ruler is not the right word I'm looking for, but champion to step up and wrest Italy back away from the pernicious influence of the French and the Spaniards. Having read that and then read the Discourses on Livy, what he says very explicitly at one point in the text is, he says, look, if you're going to be a republic, either you need to solidify what you've got or you got to expand. And the question before us is, what's the right kind of government for each of those strategies? That's where he talks about the Roman form of government that included a system of checks and balances between the populace, the aristocrats, and the consuls.
You mean the consuls at CON?
Consuls. Yeah. I'm sorry, consuls.
Yeah, the sort of the dual.
You had sort of the executive, the legislative, and the, you know, judicial.
Well, it seemed actually more like the high house, the House of Lords, the House of Commons.
Yes, I'm sorry. And he does have a chapter where he talks about the need to have a judiciary. But he basically says that the Roman form of government was the right form of government if you want to have a republic that's going to grow and expand. Probably not the right form of government if you want to entrench the power that you have. All that being said, it has inherent flaws, which, you know, were the seeds of its own destruction and so on and so forth. In that light, what I was reading was that he was saying, we need unification in Italy. We need a strong personality to step forward. And the Prince is really his call to action for some sort of ambitious person to come and take power and to help unify. I don't think he thinks that that's the ultimate form of government that you need to labor under, but I do think he thinks that the Prince is a guide to action for the type of ambitious person who could found a republic if they so desired, like Romulus.
Well, he rules out the Republic in The Prince, though, right?
No, I'm reading into it. I'm saying, okay. He's saying we need a prince to unify Italy, but then that person could establish a Republic. We need somebody to defeat the French and the Spaniards.
You were mentioning the last chapter of The Prince. It's called An Exhortation to Liberate Italy from the Barbarians. So this in the very last paragraph, this opportunity, therefore, ought not to be allowed to pass for letting Italy at last see her liberator appear. Nor can one express the love with which he would be received in all those provinces which have suffered so much from foreign scourings. With what thirst for revenge, with what stubborn faith, with what devotion, with what tears, what door would be closed to him? Who would refuse obedience to him? Etc. Yeah. So he seemed to think that only, it's not a matter of systemic change, that at this point in the particular historical situation that he was in with different factions, different cities ruled by different things. The church, he was saying, was strong enough, not strong enough to actually take over Italy, but too strong to keep anybody else from taking over Italy.
Yeah.
But then all these different factions would be constantly inviting foreign powers in to, you know, fight for their side. And he really thought that it was not a matter of, you know, any kind of systemic change. The only thing that could conquer this was one extremely talented individual to rise up and inspire and get all of the Italian people themselves to join together and fight.
He's looking for a godfather. No, I'm just kidding. Interestingly enough, Italy's still no better off today, 2010. No, well, that's not right. I shouldn't say that. No, I think, Seth, too, what you were saying, that's a key point. Because even if you want to found a republic, in the beginning, you have to seize authority. It's like dictatorship of the proletariat, almost. You know, you start out with this authoritarian, you know, he talks about, yes, a state needs good laws, and this is in the Prince, but the foundation of good laws is good arms. Without power, without force, you can't get to that. You know, it reminds me of when people say, yeah, I'm glad that the troops are fighting for your right to say that. You know, if you say make some liberal criticism of the United States government, the implication is that, yeah, it's all well and good to have your bleeding heart values, but what founds that? Ultimately, the state is founded on violence, and you can't even get to Christian values unless they're sort of enclosed in this harsher real politic, let's say.
That's a good point, Wes. And at a couple of junctures in the discourses, he says we almost have to excuse Romulus from killing Remus and all of the other atrocities that he committed, because there's a certain amount of that is necessary in the founding of a state. Or he says that we should at least judge them not too harshly, I think, something like that.
I think there's something really something disturbing about the Prince, and that is that it reminds us that there is no way around this sort of amorality, that the order that makes ethics possible is fundamentally amoral. And so it's a fundamental paradox that I don't know how you get around it.
Here, I've got a quote from the discourses. This is in chapter 18.
Is this Discourses or the Prince?
In Discourses. He's talking about if the state is corrupt. He says, and as for the sudden reform of institutions, which are seen by all to be no longer good, I say that defects which are easily discerned are not easily corrected. Because for their correction is not enough to use ordinary means, these being in themselves insufficient, but recourse must be had to extraordinary means such as violence and arms. Mm. And as a preliminary, you must become prince of the city and able to deal with it at your pleasure. But since the restoration of a state to a new political life presupposes a good man, and to become the prince of a city by violence presupposes a bad man, it can consequently very seldom happen that, although the end be good, a good man will be found ready to become a prince by evil ways. Mm. Or that a bad man, having become a prince, will be disposed to act virtuously. So to get anything done, you gotta know when to be cruel. And he acknowledges then that you need to be perceived as being consistent and upright and a man of your word, and not somebody that can be pushed around, right? Not somebody who's going to change his mind in the face of circumstance.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there's a certain consistency and strength that is, it's not exactly the opposite of Christian virtue. I guess it's just back to, it's a different conception of virtue.
Well, there's
aiming at the good.
Speaking of welching on the treaty, by the way, one of the things that he was impressed by was Caesar Borgia went to, I forget what city-state it was, but he basically said, can you lend me your catapults or whatever it was to take over this other state who's your rival? So they lent it, I think it was Urbino. So they lend him the catapult, and then he uses it to take over Urbino. And Machiavelli thought very highly of that. That was one of his examples of using deception. And then the...
Actually, that kind of raises a good point, Wes. So we wouldn't say that the actions of a prince, as described by Machiavelli in The Prince, would be appropriate for, say, a consul or even a leading citizen in a republic. Is that correct?
Now, I think when it comes to relations with other states, even in a republic, it's amoral. I think despite the promotion of liberty within the state, when it comes to other states, you're doing whatever you can to get one over on...
Right, but I mean, the prince is the ultimate authority in his state. And he talks about how when a prince has to make a decision between, do you use servants to carry out functions for you, or do you have like an aristocracy, right, or a nobility? And he says, you don't want to deal with the nobility. It's too complicated. And there's certainly no granting of power to the plebeian. What I'm saying is that the structure of a republic, as he describes it, with sort of leaders, a House of Lords, a House of Commons, and a judiciary, are completely inappropriate in the context where you have a prince as a leader. So I'm wondering if his description of the prince or of the type of prince or what's needed is very, very specifically tied or requires a concept of a Renaissance or medieval city-state, and that it's not a guide for individual action, like in terms of individual ethical conduct between people. And it's certainly not appropriate if you have an established republic. It's only for somebody who wants to come and take power or an establish a state or take power from an existing state.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's very interesting, yeah, whether it translates into personal behavior and what the differences are between when you're founding the principality and when it becomes a republic. Because in The Prince, he talks explicitly about deceiving populace and how easily deceived they are, and about appearing to be, say, magnanimous without necessarily being that. But in the discourses, he concentrates explicitly on not corrupting those institutions, not putting private gain above public gain, above the community. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Does he talk in the discourses about deceiving the people? You know, he encourages religion, which I think he sees as a kind of deception.
Well, he explicitly says that you should use religion as a means of control, successful states will do that, and to the extent of talking about using soothsayers to predict, you know, favorable outcomes of battles, and just, you know, and what do you do if the soothsayers end up being wrong in some circumstances?
Oh, okay.
And things like that. And really, there was another quote here somewhere that was even the more so that people are sort of scientific in their thinking, in other words, should be sort of enlightened beyond the silliness of religion. That's not what he's spelling out, but that's kind of what he's implying here. Those people should be all the more in favor of religion being promoted, because they should see the causal effect that has on keeping the state together and people keeping people in line.
But he also says in the discourses that it's critical for a republic or a state to have accusation.
Right.
Versus calumny.
And which is false accusation, which is accusation that's sort of slander.
It's slander,
not a formal accusation.
To some extent, he's calling for, hey, you know, you need to have open dialogue or the ability to confront your accusers in public, have them be held accountable for any claims that they're making. It's kind of a weird balance, I guess.
Again, as a release valve.
Well, it's not just...
If you don't give them means to do that, they're going to, like, lynch somebody or...
Well, no, not only that, he says it sows these seeds of discontent. Now, he was talking about it in the context of being able to prevent individuals from gaining too much power through false accusation and riling up the masses or what have you. I kind of want to get back to Wes's point about, you know, can you basically say that the prince isn't really about being a prince? It's about the acquisition of power. This is the way that you gain power. This is the way you forge a state, or this is the way you take power away from somebody else who has a state. And guess what? This is what you have to do it.
Okay, so there's a fundamental part I'll read here from the beginning of the discourses that's in chapter 2. It's the second paragraph that says to me that anybody who is the target audience of the prince, anybody who has just gotten power, needs to know what the best kind of government is. So all these things he says about giving rights to the people and having a place for the noble, all this applies to the prince as well. So here's the paragraph in question. Some who have written of republics say that there are one of three states governments in them, called by principality, which is the same as monarchy, of the best, which is the same as aristocracy, and popular, which is the name same as democracy. Monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. Some others, and wiser according to the opinion of many, believe there are six kinds of government, of which those are very bad, and those are good in themselves, but may so easily be corrupted that they also become pernicious. Those that are good are the three mentioned above, and those that are bad are three others which derive from the first. And each is so similar to them that they easily jump from one to the other. For the principality easily becomes a tyranny, autocracy easily becomes a state of the few, oligarchies, and the popular democracy, without difficulty, is converted into a licentious one, to anarchy.
Your translation sucks.
Yeah, this is the online version. Okay. I remember the version I was reading on the Kindle was quite a bit nicer.
Yeah, it's a good...
It didn't have all this stuff in parentheses.
Yeah.
So much so that the organizer of a republic institutes one of these three governments in a city, institutes it only for a short time because there's no remedy which can prevent them from degenerating to their opposite kind because of the resemblance that virtue and vice have in this instance. So in other words, if you're starting a monarchy, it is going to slip into tyranny, you know, at least within a generation or two, almost inevitably, unless you don't just have a monarchy, unless you institute this
mixed.
This mixed form. So you need to have really a constitutional monarchy is what he wants.
Yeah.
Not that he's going to say, yeah, so that you...
Well, the monarchy comes to correspond to the executive, the aristocracy to the House of Lords, or, you know, the Senate, whatever you want to call it, and then democracy to the House.
House of Commons, or at least having a forum from which to accuse or something like that. And I really thought this was interesting and applicable to today. You know, to get anything done, you have to have some kind of singular vision. You have to have the president say, I'm just to try to stuff this into America for a second, as I'm sure we'll get to there eventually here tonight. You need some sort of unified vision running things in order to get anything done. Something that we often complain in America about the rich having too much power and corporatism. Well, really, according to Machiavelli, they really should have some definite outlet for their power. Otherwise, they're just going to take over. Like, they have power. They have money. Money is power. They could raise an army and take over the government themselves. We're much better off having corporate lobbyists that in sneaky ways, you know, subvert the legislative process, but they don't have entire control of it. You know, there's still individual instances in which some of them can be defeated and they don't, you know, they're not at least not banding together necessarily. It's different corporate interests fighting for different things. It gives them an outlet. And then, of course, our country is a republic, despite what people think, that it's not a democracy unless you live in California and they put everything on a referendum. Which is a terrible idea, but in any case, there, you know, you need to have the people feel like they're represented too, and, you know, have a legitimate means. Oh, we get to vote for the president, we get to vote for our legislative officials. So, I mean, really, we're operating on some of the insights that he came up with, whether we realize it or not.
But he does talk, by the way, explicitly about checking the ambitions of the rich and how they can corrupt the state. And so it is, again, it is checks and balances. But he does think that the aristocracy is necessary because the people are no better. They can lead to complete anarchy or the state of California.
He does say, so in one of the early chapters of Discourses, he asks sort of who's, are the rich people or the poor people the better guardians of freedom in a republic? And he says, well, what the rich people want to do is to oppress. what the poor people want is just to keep from being oppressed. So really, the commoners are better. Even if you could argue that, oh, well, the aristocracy, they're more educated, or, you know, they probably know what they're doing in terms of statehood more. But still, you know, it'd probably be better to put a little more power in the hands of people who just want you to leave them alone rather than to put it in the power of people that actively want to oppress others.
Especially in the form of guns. We've got the Second Amendment right here, you know.
Well, that's okay. So that's a good transition to his feelings about war and having a military kind of populace. If you have too much peace, your populace will grow effeminate and will be taken over by neighboring countries.
But also, it's important to have one's own militia rather than these professional mercenaries, which is really interesting. And these mercenaries, they would contract one city-state one day, and then to another the next. And he mentions this guy, John Hawkwood, this illiterate English guy who ran something called the White Company, which makes me think of Blackwater, and came in and made a fortune fighting for all the different city-states. And in the end, I think he ended up doing a good job for Florence, and they buried him in the Duomo. But he's explicitly against these mercenaries, and which I found very fascinating, this idea of one's own versus what's other and what's external to the state.
You know, the thing is, Wes, his talk about all that stuff, though, is it all comes down to practical matters. When he's talking about the mercenaries, he's saying that, you know, they're brave during peacetime and cowards during war, and that they're happily take your money when they don't have to do anything. But as soon as you put them to the test, they run off. The discussion was all about if you're gonna secure your state or if you're gonna go and wage war, you need to do it with people who've got something at stake, like somebody who's got something to lose. So he says there's basically three different things. You can use your own people, you can use allies, like people from a neighboring state, or you can use mercenaries. And he kind of goes through and says, here's why mercenaries are the worst. Not only that, you know, once you win, they feel entitled to take anything that you possibly have, or rather, he says, mercenaries just quit. If you use neighboring states, like if you use somebody else's army to do it, then they feel entitled to the spoils that you theoretically should win. So the only way to kind of guarantee the loyalty of the troops, guarantee that they'll be tough enough to fight, and guarantee that you'll secure whatever it is that you win, is to use your own people.
Sometimes you can use less powerful allies, but yeah, he's thinking of say, Venice, or no, singing the Pope, say, inviting in France to help him go against Venice. And by the way, the Pope then later allied against... So France comes in and rides roughshod all over Italy, takes Naples, and then the Pope changes his mind and says, nah, France has become too powerful, so now I'm going to ally with Venice and, you know, some other Italian states and try and drive out France. So the idea is that, yeah, if you have a more powerful ally, you're going to win it for them, essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Either you're going to have somebody that's incompetent working with you and that are not going to be able to help effectively, or if they're too competent, then they're going to...
Yeah.
There's no reason they shouldn't take you over.
Yeah.
Yeah, boy, that was as judicious a criticism of the church as I think you'll find. It's a little too temporal, I think is the word he used. Too much sort of worldly power, but not enough. If you're going to do it, do it. The Pope should have just become a warrior Pope.
Well, you know, at the beginning of the Republic, and by the way, he actually raised a militia during his time in government in Florence, successfully implemented that and had Florence use its own forces in battles, which was actually successful at first. And then they all ran away when Florence, I think, finally fell again to the Medicis. They just turned tail and ran. He worked for the Secretary of Art, what we would call the Secretary of State, State Department. Yeah, they put him in charge of raising a militia, and he did. And Florence went from using mercenaries to using a militia, which worked out well at first, but it didn't work out well in the end. And some historians think that actually the mercenaries could do quite well. They were pretty crafty about preventing casualties, but you know, they were actually pretty skilled.
You know, since Blackwater can't get as many contracts now because they got such a bad name, the U.S., they actually got a contract with the Taliban. That would be funny if that happened.
I wouldn't put it past them. I wouldn't put it past them.
Taliban does not have enough money. That's the problem. They would not accept payment in opium. I don't believe.
Yeah.
Blackwater.
And put it past them. I want to go back to this point about establishing or a state and then versus maintaining or persevering. Chapter 11 of the Discourses, he says, the welfare of a republic or a kingdom, therefore, is not in having a prince who governs prudently while he lives, but one who organizes it in a way that, if he should die, it will still maintain itself. There's an implied kind of criticism there of, I guess, monarchies or absolute monarchies, in that succession does not guarantee. You could have the greatest statesperson and the greatest prince, but there's no guarantee that any offspring that prince has are going to be able to continue that, because it is so reliant upon individual virtue. And he talks in the Discourses, and I think actually, or maybe in the Prince, about Alexander and what happened to Macedonia. But he says, you know, that Alexander actually laid the correct foundations for Macedonia's to thrive after he passed, but that unfortunately the rulers of the four states or five states that it was broken into just couldn't get along and couldn't figure out their own shit. But if they just had, there was nothing wrong with the overall organization of the state that would have caused a problem. But that kind of is getting to his point that rather than create kind of five potentates, breaking up his one individual kingdom into five sub-kingdoms, if he had created a judiciary and created a republic, that you have a better chance of maintaining the state over time. So I don't know. I'm sure that, Wes, you got some exposure to classical Greek history and politics and philosophies. Mm-hmm. You know, you read Thucydides and Herodotus, and you read about the Peloponnesian Wars and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that the narrative of Western culture is a narrative where Athens is this beacon of truth and justice that brings democracy and reason and all this other shit into the world, and that Sparta, as the kind of opposition to Athens, represents a kind of provincial militaristic mindset, that Sparta is never considered as having flourished or contributed anything great to the world the way Athens did. And these are the two great powers of the Greek era, the ancient world. And what I thought was interesting was the section that Mark read earlier from chapter 2, which is really Machiavelli's little State of Nature. It's his version of Hobbes, because you have people, they enter into contracts and blah, 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 and then you get these different forms of government. It ends with a comparison of Athens to Sparta, and he actually says that Sparta was the superior state because of its persistence and because the king drafted up basically what he considers to be a perfect set of laws to run the state, and that they stuck to it. And they deviated for a little while, but then somebody came along who kind of reinstated them.
I think it's because he just saw 300. Spartans, tonight we died in hell.
Oh, well, gosh.
I don't know about his attitude towards Sparta exactly. You know, he was an Athenian general, and he wrote the Peloponnesian Wars to give a critique of what went on. But yeah, that's an accurate description of what Sparta and Athens represented. Sparta, of course, did some good stuff, you know, kicked some Persian ass, even despite getting ultimately defeated at Thermopylae.
In reference to what Mark was saying about creating the balance between the three pillars of state, and he says that Solon gave too much power to the populace, and that ultimately was the demise of Athens. You know,
yeah, that's
Sparta,
probably Thucydides' critique, yeah.
No, this is Machiavelli's.
I know, but he's probably just lifting.
Oh, you
Thucydides
think he's just
critique.
Lifting
right.
It?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it fits in well. I don't know. His net point is that Sparta lasted a lot longer than Athens, and that was as a credit to or due to the structure of government that they imposed versus what the Athenians did. And just bringing it back to this point that you can read these two texts in tandem as describing, one, how to take power, and two, how to keep and expand it. And that there's no suggestion that he thinks that the prince is a blueprint for how to govern a state effectively over the long
haul.
Well,
and also just a discussion of all the different situations that you can be in. There is no guidebook. There are a lot of general principles that you should keep in mind, but there are a lot of historical contingencies, and it matters a lot sort of what the situation is on the ground when you come in. So it's not just a simple list of here's exactly what you have to do. As somebody said earlier, to be flexible is really the big thing, as Wes was saying, in your strategy.
I think what he's saying, though, is that if you're a prince, you're going to die someday. And what happens after you die? If you have not set up the state to thrive and persist after you die, then you have essentially failed. But nothing in the prince that tells you how to do that.
Right. It's interesting that the chapter that you quoted there, 11, is about of the religions of the Romans. So in saying that you should set up things to make the state exist beyond themselves, he was really talking primarily about, again, that religious control, that if you have customs that will keep people in line, like there's no substitute for that. I mean, when you don't have the customs, you need to put laws in place, but the customs are first and foremost. And in the prince, he says specifically, if you come in and take power, you want to change as little as possible because people hate change. Like if you come in and you displace their former ruler, but you pretty much run things just like the former ruler did, most people are going to be fine with it.
If you're taking over a place that has an established ruler, yes.
Yes. Whereas anytime you make a change, he says, you're going to make some enemies, anybody that was benefiting under the former rules, and you're not going to gain very warm friends. The people that will be benefiting, in fact, there's another quote I should find here, something to the effect that pretty much if you institute a fairer form of government so that people sort of just get what they earn. Well, the people that are benefiting from that, they'll feel like they're just getting what they earn, right? They're not going to thank you for setting that up, the ruler. They're going to just be proud of themselves for gaining this. So you've made some enemies, and the people that are benefiting don't appreciate you for it. So just don't do that kind of stuff. Just keep, in fact, you don't want, you know, absolute corruption. You want, you know, if at every level people are just abusing whatever system you've set up. So he used the example of, well, you could, you know, allow anybody to run for office, but in a corrupt state, as you could examine the way America is now, it's like, oh no, the only people that can run for office are people that, because the campaign financing laws, they have to sell themselves to corporations. Like that's the kind of, he doesn't like that kind of thing, but he likes a little bit of corruption. He likes the ability of the ruler to give out favors, to make people personally grateful to the ruler. Like, and that's corruption.
Yeah.
Hunger and poverty make men industrious, and laws make them good.
Yes. He has a very negative view of human nature, that unless people are kept in line, they are going to, and it's not just that they will betray, but they're just fractious. I mean, that's a big thing. Again, this is not so much a moral, there's no moral condemnation about human nature here. People want power, and they want to benefit themselves. And so you just have to acknowledge that fact and figure out how to act appropriately.
And yeah, I think he admires power too, as an exercise of free will in some sense against fortune and virtu and manliness and all those glory and greatness. He's very focused on those things.
Yeah, he does spend. No, that's a good point, Wes. I mean, he spends a fair amount of time. This is why it was good not to kind of ignore the examples he's giving, the case studies. He speaks with a certain degree of, well, first off, there's the relating of the details of person X or person Y and how they managed to come to power and all that. But then there's also clearly a certain amount of admiration when he's talking about how, for example, this one person came to power and this other person came to power and the ways they did it. He's trying to give you example to go by. And he also clearly assumes that there are classes. It's a part of the structure of what he's talking about, that there will be an aristocracy or nobility at the very least, even if there isn't a political aristocracy, the idea that there are noble families or bloodlines, and then you have kind of the popular. These are kind of critical, I think, to his conception.
There's no utopian ideal, and I don't think he thinks that's possible. There's no ultimate communist society where class is obliterated or anything like that.
I think what he really wants is just political stability. I mean, right.
There's no historical progress even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And during his lifetime, he probably saw a huge amount of change. These intrigues and the city-states and political alliances. You have the Spain and France and the Venetians, who were power for thousands and thousands of years. The fact that he spends all this time talking about Rome is to talk about stability. He's sick of bad government and changing rulers and battles over small kingdoms and all that stuff. And I think he's just like, what we need is political stability. We need a unified state. I want to live someplace where I know that, you know, I can send my kids to school and they're going to grow up and be X, Y, and Z, and I just don't want it to be a Frenchman or a Spaniard.
Although, you know, he hung out and with the Frenchmen and Spaniards, and, you know, Cesare Borgia, you know, is considered one of the heroes of France. He was of Spanish, Portuguese origin, and Machiavelli greatly admired him and also admired King Ferdinand of Spain.
It's true.
So, but I think it is about stability, but then it's about the humiliation of the Italian city-states, but especially Florence, and humiliation of Italy in the sense that he, you know, if there's one utopian idea there, it's the idea that Italy can be unified. There's that element of patriotism there. He's quoted as saying in some letter, "I love my country more than I love my soul," something like that. And that's the inversion of values that's going on from the Christian to this fundamentally political, which, you know, reminds me of Aristotle and virtue ethics. And after all, he is talking about a lot of the great man and what makes the man great. And he's talking about ethics in that sense, as opposed to Christian sense.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't really think stability, I think, is possible, that things change. Things, you can't stop the change. So it's usually a matter, as he puts it, of choosing between different kinds of annoyances, different kinds of disruptions. And trying to choose the one that is the least evil of them.
Yeah, well, he says disruptions in the sense of checks and balances are desirable. You know, he looks at some of the conflicts between the plebeians and the nobles in Rome and the aristocracy as positive things, where other commentators saw it as part of the chaos that led to the downfall of Rome.
Right, he said that all political reforms come out of this kind of conflict. So the things that would guarantee freedom are, for instance, the plebeians are paranoid that their freedom is going to be taken away because somebody really is trying to take their freedom away. And if they continue to be paranoid beyond the facts, then you have to go to public meetings and argue with them. Here, I have a quote here. "For though they be ignorant, the people are not therefore, as Cicero says, incapable of being taught the truth, but are readily convinced when it is told to them by one in whose honesty they can trust."
Go ahead. Well, I was going to change the subject.
That's all right.
No, I was just going to get to the whole elephant in the room of
George Bush.
George Bush and America and the war on terror. And
America!
Fuck yeah.
Of course, I was reading this with clearly in mind, wow, it sure seems like in the climate change treaty, just going out of his way to show that we can blow off treaties and really just the show of power that seemed so weird and unreasonable at the time, seems like it could explain it by saying, oh yeah, he just read the prince. He's trying his best to live up to it.
I think there's a lot of glorification of Machiavelli among some of the intellectual circles like Bill Kristol and other tough guy neocons. And then, you know, you have some conservative intellectuals like Harvey Mansfield, who wrote a book on manliness, which is basically the virtu thing, and I think it's highly of Machiavelli. I think they have this idea of the necessity of being really tough and how that's important to the state. But as I was reading The Prince and some of the discourses, I think what's interesting is Machiavelli's emphasis on the integrity of institutions, which is precisely the liberal argument against doing things like, say, waterboarding or military tribunals,
mm-hmm.
that it's actually highly damaging to the state to corrupt those things. So you can masquerade as saying, yeah, we're just being tough on foreign policy, but that can actually be a cloak for institutional corruption within. It's a double-edged sword. I don't think Machiavelli is the tool for what some on the right make it out to be.
I guess I saw the most of it in there, not in sort of what the Republican Party professes to believe, but just the methods that they actually use. So, you know, using religion as a way to control people is an obvious one. That you must appear virtuous in this way. You must appear godly. And ultimately, this belief that, yes, we have institutions, but it all comes down to force. Force is the only way that the institutions can stay in place. He says at one point that the armed prophets throughout history were all destroyed. I mean, sorry, the unarmed prophets were all destroyed. The armed prophets have been the only ones that have been successful.
That's a reference, so, by the way. I wanted to mention this because this is find fascinating too. The Savonarola, basically this crazy Dominican priest who took over in the early stages of the Republic, and he had one of the most notorious bonfire of the vanities where he personally threw in Botticelli paintings and many other works of art were lost that way. And then a few years later, you know, they turned on him and he was burned to death in exactly that place, tortured first and then burned to death. But anyway, I think his main critique of Savonarola was that he preached a lot, but he wasn't tough enough. Not tough enough for Machiavelli. Anyway, sorry if that threw it off, but I wanted to mention that.
Well, even on the other way, like I was thinking of this just in terms of this belief that, you know, that ideas will adapt themselves. If you get force in place, other things will fall into play. I remember my junior high social studies teacher telling me something. This was when communism was introduced to me. You know, communism sharing sounds like a good idea. Maybe is a good idea, but that the state of Russia and the state of China think that they should force it down your throats that way. That force this sharing down your throat. So it seems like Machiavelli might agree with that. Like if you want anything, any substantial change, you need to accomplish it by force of arms.
Yeah, but you can't oppress the internal populace and maintain stability. You can deceive them. You can persuade them. You can use religion to control them, but you're not going to have any fortresses. You're going to keep them armed and you're going to make sure that they don't hate you, even if they're awed by you and fear you.
Yeah, he certainly didn't have any 1984-ish, even though it suggests that he would advocate, hey, let's even make, you know, you a religious figure as the prince, so that you are reverenced as a god or something, or, you know, 1984 Orwellian talk, so that, like, let's all sing the praises of the corporation every morning when you're going to work in a Japanese company, or, you know, just this sort of mind control things. It doesn't seem like he'd thought of that, but it seems like he wouldn't have been against it.
I don't know. I think in some ways he's obviously right. The states are founded upon force, and especially in the beginning, there's no peaceful hunter-gatherers get together and they're all nice to each other. It's brutal people take power and force together this community. The community itself is based on an act of violence. Once you've reached a certain stage, you know, you look at the way things are today, first of all, with the technology of war, much different than Machiavelli's time, international relations. If you were to apply what Machiavelli was saying, I think he would say, no, you don't go to waste your resources on Iraq, for instance. You know, even if you wanted to be the tough guy Machiavellian, I don't think it's even practical from the standpoint of real politics.
It was fun to think about some of the specific advice that he was giving about, you know, what to do after you've taken over a country, to compare that with our experiences with Iraq and Afghanistan. He says, oh, if a place has been controlled by an absolute ruler, then it's actually very easy to maintain control of a kind of place, because people aren't used to being able to think and act independently. So if you just knock out the ruler and kill the ruler's kids, then you can become the new ruler. And oh, that worked out really well. Like, we found exactly the opposite of that, like, once people were freed from this, then they rose up in many different directions en masse.
I don't know how many of the oppressed rose up. They kicked out all of the ruling party, all of the Ba'athists, all the people who did have a lot to lose. It's like getting rid of the entire nobility, the entire aristocracy. Uh-huh. When you go into a state, yeah, you kill off the ruling family and their kids and stuff like that. But I don't think he advocated impoverishing the entire nobility, because then I think naturally you're going to see a resistance.
Another thing if you are conquering someplace that doesn't speak your language and is just a very foreign, really the only way to make sure you keep control is to go live there yourself. So I think Bush should have taken that advice. Of course, just, you know, describing a totally different historical situation, right, of more, but more, also, which city state should I invade? Or if I invade part of France, maybe I should go live there and have a villa.
And then Bush should have been the head of the army too. He should have been at the forefront with a saber in hand, leading the tanks in. At least he did the carrier landing thing. You know, that was at least a token effort at being a prince, to put on the jumpsuit and land on carrier, mission accomplished.
That's what I was saying. It seems like the whole wag the dog thing, it seems like Machiavelli's recommending that. You should keep the state in a state of war, not just to keep your people from getting soft, but to keep them rallied around you, just to give them something to do so they don't try to take you down.
And Machiavelli's understanding of the way that the structure, the geopolitical structure for his day and age is very different than ours is. There's just no, I'm not saying there's no practical advice that you could get out of this as a text for leadership today. It just seems to me that the Discourses on Livy is a much more useful text to a modern political ruler than the Prince would ever be.
Yeah, and I don't know how much of an influence it had on English political theory, but obviously there's the commonality and the emphasis on liberty, and that of course made its way into the United States Constitution and the sort of the
how much
founding
influence
principles of...
This is interesting. That's an interesting point, Wes. This is a very well-known, so the Prince, at least, is an extremely well-known text. And there's a verb now, Machiavellian, which means a certain thing. And yet, I would be very surprised if you could find traces of the political theory that it espouses in modern political doctrine. All the political theory that comes in founding the Republic of France after the monarchy, after the French Revolution, the modern Soviet state, the modern German Republic, and even the Weimar, the Republic before that, the United States. You're not going to find any of this stuff.
Well, you don't.
Not explicitly.
You're writing a constitution.
Yeah.
When you're writing a constitution or writing the Declaration of Independence or something, you talk about ideals. Well, that's, Machiavelli will give you practical advice on how to set things up.
But
it's
you do see
the flowery words.
You see the checks and balances and the idea of a mixed state and the importance of liberty. And look at the Second Amendment.
The Discourses does sound a lot like that. I guess the question we should ask is, would you say that Stalin was Machiavellian? And if so, how would you rate his success on the Machiavellian scale? He was clearly amoral, clearly an absolute ruler, clearly created the pretense that there was a state.
Set up some institutions that lasted for quite a while after him.
He did set up some institutions that lasted for quite a while after him.
You mean until 1989 or so? Or?
Yeah. Well, you know.
For 40 years?
80 years isn't too bad. It's kind of funny to think that the United States is like one of the oldest countries.
More like 50 years.
Was it only 50? No.
Since the founding of the state is what he means, Lenin.
The Bolsheviks, though.
It was 50 years since Stalin.
Oh. Yeah, but there was a lot of chaos early on, and then...
But I mean, he killed millions of people. He gave the appearance of normalcy, but was clearly a psychopath. Well, actually, he continued to perpetrate atrocities over time, whereas Machiavelli says,
"Yeah,
you don't want to continue to antagonize.
Do it all at once, so you don't have to keep doing it."
Well, he was also he was hated. He basically established an abuse of power for an aristocracy, and he impoverished his country.
He was feared.
He was feared, but he was also hated, which is, you have to avoid being hated at all costs. And
right.
I think a lot of his decisions led directly to, I mean, look at World War II. That was a disaster for Russia. I'm not sure that he could have avoided it with Hitler, but there wasn't much long-term institutional integrity, and they lost the USSR. They crumbled.
What about Napoleon?
He liked Napoleon, right? No, it was a little beforehand. Nietzsche was admiring Napoleon, and if Machiavelli is like Nietzsche, therefore Machiavelli would have admired Napoleon.
Well, how long did Napoleon last? Not very long. I don't know.
I guess what I'm saying is that if you look at the political theorists that we revere, the English political theorist and French political theorists that created all these great principles that there are many, 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 many modern states are built on. And you go and you look at Discourses on Livy and you see him doing a historical evaluation of Rome and essentially advocating many of those same political principles, balance of power, strong judiciary, public discourse. And you say, okay, there's something to these ideas. Now let's say, can you find anybody who did what the prince advocates and was successful? Was it really an influential text intellectually, even?
Well, it was hugely influential intellectually. Even if it was just a matter of people responding to it and demonizing it, although, you know, Rousseau, for instance, was very fond of Machiavelli and thought it was a satire, thought that he was just showing you how despots would behave so that you could deal with them, which I think is, you know, obviously that's an out there interpretation. Not long after it was published, created a huge scandal that lasts a long time. I mean, Shakespeare was aware of him and mentioned him. The whole idea of something being Machiavellian, by the 1600s, that was already established as an idea.
So that's infamy. He was definitely infamous, but was it an intellectually influential text that guided political or ethical thought? I guess that's my question.
Well, at least it produced responses, I think.
It definitely produced responses.
You can certainly see, again, we could imagine George Bush reading this. We could imagine Stalin reading this and trying to apply things, but taking the advice piecemeal. Again, there are these two strains in here that makes it hard to figure out what his advice exactly is, in that depending on your circumstance, you should be very conservative. So he says, people will not mind what you do as long as you don't kill them or their relatives and don't take their stuff. Don't take their women.
Yeah, that's
don't take their wives and daughters away. So look, Stalin violated that way too much. I mean, you're supposed to just
by an order of a few million or
yes, you're supposed to just move in, do whatever damage you need to do right away. So kill all your political enemies and then try to have things calm down as quickly as possible. Like, you don't just continue ruling as an authoritarian. So in that way, George Bush was a much better Machiavellian than Stalin. That George Bush is really trying to, really all these conservatives are just appealing your conservative values. But then, on the other hand, this notion of greatness that Wes was referring to, that we also see in trying to keep the state at war all the time. And so, you know, where does that lead you? To me, that those seem to be conflicting aims. You should just keep your house secure so you can get through your reign without upsetting things so that people get mad at you and depose you. That's like an immediate piece of advice. But on the other hand, you should set up grand institutions and you should get your state on a path of growth and greatness. Those don't go together to me.
Why don't they go together? One's more conservative?
Yeah.
Well, but that's inner versus outer, right? That's the way you treat your own populace versus the state's relation to other states.
Sure, okay. So you could see the American conservatives trying to do both of those with no conflict.
Yeah, what I would say is they don't. But I mean, you look at American history, it was an easier case in a sense, because in the founding, all you had to do was drive out English and then apply a little English political philosophy to founding your institutions. But, you know, you look at some of the things that were done. So, for instance, a popular militia had a huge role in driving out the English, and a strong leader who was idealized, like Washington. And, you know, and then that transition to well-established institutions. And then, again, the Second Amendment, arming the populace. I see some of that in the prince. And then if you look at, for better or for worse, the United States has been largely at war, for involved in one war or another for most of its history.
You know, that's funny, Wes, because my reading of that was actually that it seems so much more about the discourses on Livy. At one point he says, and this is chapter 6, if anyone should therefore want to establish a new republic, he should have to consider if he should want it to expand in dominion and power as did Rome, or whether it should remain within narrow limits. The key is that if you want it to expand and grow, you have to give arms and power to the populace. And if you want it to remain within its narrow limits, you have to make sure to sort of disenfranchise the populace in favor of the aristocracy, or at least disenfranchise the populace. And so my question when I read that was, are we still in a state of expanding? Or now that we're no longer expanding, does the fact that we have the right to bear arms create a situation where we're lending ourselves to abuse by the populace and descending from democracy into anarchy? And this is where I think about armed militias that decide they're going to go kill abortion doctors, or the kind of crazed actions where people are essentially deciding that they're just going to ignore the legal and moral rights of other people because they disagree with their political stance or whatever. I feel like we're more likely to descend into anarchy than we are to experience something at the political level that's going to be catastrophic.
that resonates with me there, because it seems like even though the purpose people who espouse the Second Amendment voice is, it's really so if the government turns bad and comes to get you, you should be able to defend yourself.
Yes. And
but it seems that the nature of arms have changed such that the government is the only one that is not in any danger from you and your little militia.
Yeah.
The government will come with its choppers and it'll have a Waco. If you make your little self a little compound, they're going to come and take you out.
Well, like, it's much more likely you're going to... You can always fight an insurgency, though, as in Iraq.
I suppose that's... Yeah, I guess that's been the hope of some crazy rightists, but...
Yeah, it's crazy.
I see that you have... The difference in political opinions is the difference in whether or not you have faith in the established system of justice or you don't. And that if you believe in the judiciary and you believe in the law, then you're going to sit around and you're going to say, people who commit crimes are going to be brought to justice. And then if you don't, you're going to say, I have a gun. These people are not going to be brought to justice, so I'm going to go bring them to justice. And you see people, the history, you talked about the United States being at war throughout most of its history, Wes. Thank God for that, because what would we be doing with all that energy and need for violence and expansion and all that stuff if it was pointed inward?
That's a depressing thought if that's required.
I mean, I'm certainly not the first person who's ever suggested that.
It would go into wrestling.
And football, baby, football.
And Halo.
Fight all our wars virtually as Call of Duty 4 into the win at the winner take all.
You know, I thought I remembered something in one of these readings about, it was in the prints, about don't let big issues be decided without really putting yourself, all of your resources behind them. We often might say, oh, I wish, can't George Bush and Saddam Hussein, can't they just go, you know, Saddam Hussein actually challenged him to a shootout, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can't all these warmongers just go?
Star Trek era Klaatu type knife fight things.
Yes. Yeah. Can't they go take themselves out? Well, Machiavelli, you know, even gives a historical example, I believe, of that kind of thing. It says that's just foolish. If you're the more powerful country, go send your whole fucking army to wipe them out.
No. What you do is you pretend that you will do the fight, and then once everyone's in the room, you just slaughter all of their people. You know, the army jumps out.
That's right. So philosophy,
or yeah,
philosophical theory that might be in here. One place where I did find it is that you can contrast chapter 2 of the Discourses, which is his state of nature discussion, with, say, what Hobbes said. People are in conflict and they enter into contracts in order to not constantly be looking over their shoulder or constantly be fighting, but that you eventually need somebody to enforce the contract, hence the state. Mm-hmm. And what Machiavelli says is, once you get enough people on Earth, I'll read it, in fact. At the beginning of the world, the inhabitants were few and lived for a time dispersed and like beasts. Later, as the generations multiplied, they gathered together, and in order to be able to better defend themselves, they began to seek among themselves the one who was most robust and of greater courage, and made them their head and obeyed him. From this, there arose the knowledge of honest and good things, differentiating them from pernicious and evil. I don't know how that follows.
That still sounds much less violent. Oh, we found the champion and we made him the king. Not the way Wes described it, which is the way Hegel described it, which we'll read for next time, which is that society starts with one guy bashing somebody else over the head and making them a slave.
Right. No, it's two fundamentally different things. In the Hobbes story, individuals interact with each other, and the authority or power, the external power that comes to enforce, is later. In this Machiavellian view, which is really just thrown out in this one sentence, the recognition of the need for defense does not create the need for people to negotiate contracts with each other, but rather to seek a champion to organize them and lead them.
But isn't that what Hobbes recommends? He said, in order to better defend themselves, they begin to seek among themselves the one who was most robust and of greater courage, and made him their head and obeyed him. I mean, it says, for the purposes of defense, they put somebody in charge. That sounds exactly like Hobbes.
Maybe that's what Hobbes gets to at some point. But the foundation of the social contract is between two individuals. As long as they are of relatively equal stature, they can be trusted to keep their word. You don't actually even need the authority or the power figure.
No, I don't. I think you need to go back and and listen to that episode.
I thought Hobbes is all about the necessity
of
authority.
We give up,
and actually, right,
we give up our rights to the authority mutually. You're doing it and I'm doing it. And then the authority has the physical power to make sure we keep that. It's not if one of us can be trusted. The authority makes sure that we can be trusted once we give them the authority.
But I still had a conversation with you first, right? We came to an agreement. I own shit. I don't want you to steal it. You own stuff. You don't want me to steal it. We need protection from each other. We're going to come to this agreement. I won't steal your stuff. You won't steal mine. Well, how can I trust you? Well, you can't. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, then we have to mutually agree to give up power. This says, as we gather together in order to defend ourselves mutually, we have to find a leader and then obey him. It says nothing at all about interaction between individuals as a foundation for this.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's a communal, you know, it's a communal thing.
But it does bring up this relationship between authority and morality, let's say. Where does the moral law come from? And if it's from God, doesn't that arbitrariness make it amoral in some sense?
Yes. Yeah, so I think I hear what you're saying, Wes, is that both of them essentially tie the creation of the concept of justice and virtue with authority and power, and that you don't have one without the other. The point I'm trying to make is that there's a fundamental difference where there's a recognition in Hobbes of the right of the individual to self-determine, and that the act of entering into the contract and ceding power to the third authority is, it's a divestment of authority and of power, but a recognition of the necessity to do that. Here, there's no concept that the individuals have any kind of sense of self-determination or power or anything like that. It's that at some point, the world just gets so dangerous that you have to find the manliest of men to lead you, and it's better for you to just obey that person. Either be that person or obey that person. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I wrote this book that follows for that guy. Here's how that guy can run it. But you're right, then immediately follows this, okay, now you're going to make laws. You're also going to see what's good and what's evil. You're going to have the concept of hate and compassion, honor and gratefulness, those sorts of things.
Right. You're right. I wouldn't read too much, even though that's a fun academic kind of thing to do, is like, what is Machiavelli's version of the social contract? We're already with Hegel next time going to talk about the fundamental difference between those two types of social contract. Do things start with an agreement, a contract at all, or with force? That's much clearer in other places. So we can be very clear on those concepts without making any decisions about Machiavelli in particular. The Berlin article that you sent us, again, Wes.
Yeah, Isaiah Berlin.
Said that he is, how do you put it? Pretty much Machiavelli has not been successfully incorporated into the history of political philosophy, something to that extent.
Oh, he did say that? Okay.
Yeah, that's right at the beginning of it. That people don't, there's so many different interpretations of Machiavelli and such
very different ones.
that it's hard to say, you know, exactly how he contributed to the dialogue, but everybody reads him. It's like it's one of the fundamental political philosophy texts. I read this in my mm-hmm. first philosophy that I ever read for a class, and probably at all, was in a high school political science class. Mm-hmm. That
you read this in high school.
Yes, the teacher snuck in, even though it's not a philosophy class, read The Republic, Plato's Republic, and then I think this one was the second one on the list, and then some Hobbes and some other folks, Locke and folks beyond that. And it was after reading The Republic first, so The Republic asks what I would think would be the fundamental question in political philosophy, which is, what is the best kind of government? And I found it peculiar then, reading The Prince, that he doesn't seem, at least in The Prince, doesn't at all ask that. And so I'm relieved to read in discourses that he does actually have an opinion on that. But in the same way, you could see why he would be completely hostile to the way a speculative philosopher like Plato might ask about that, because he really wants to deal with what is actually possible for human beings right now to implement. I know we'll do Republic probably in a future episode, but it's a pretty freaking bizarre, completely transformative, like, oh, it'd be awesome if everybody, you know, was taken from their parents and they thought that the earth was their mother and the government was their father, and they were divided into classes of gold people and silver people, and so that the philosophers would be the rule. Like, you know, that's the kind of things that maybe gave extremist utopian political philosophers these ideas that you could do really crazy, and to the extent that they've actually been implemented in reality, it's been horrible. I mean, it's been what Lenin and Stalin were trying to do.
This is interesting, because and in Isaiah Berlin's and in his interpretation, the implication of Machiavelli is that there is no coherent ideal society, that not only is it not practically achievable, that those depictions aren't even coherent, that if you were really to think about human nature and what's best conquest for men, you would never get to those utopias. And they actually are foundations for authoritarianism, where, ironically, the seemingly authoritarian Machiavelli is a grounds for toleration and liberalism and pluralism, because that's what goes on within the state, however brutal its founding is and however warlike its stance towards other states is.
One thing we haven't brought up here is how he recommends keeping foreigners out.
No.
As a pernicious influence. I mean, that's...
I thought he recommended immigration.
Maybe I'm just I'm remembering some specific passages where he was saying sort of how you keep control of a populace. And one of the ways of doing that is you can't have too many foreigners coming in and bringing their weird ideas and things that are going to disrupt your setup. Okay. You have to have a finite number of players. You know, pretty much there are just a few dozen people that you have to deal with when you're founding a state or trying to keep a state, like the people that actually have influence. This is even when dealing with the populace, that they have demagogues among them. They have influential people. They have rulers among them, so that you could pretty much round up everybody that you need to and bribe them or off them or whatever you need to do to deal with the vast majority of your problems. But if you have a completely open society where new ideas and foreign peoples are coming in, that really screws that up.
I think elsewhere he talks about having enough people for a militia, and so you let immigrants in because they build your army, essentially.
Maybe a matter of how much they integrate.
I guess.
Because, again, you want, right, you want people fighting for you.
Yeah.
So if they're not going to...
Yeah.
And that's, again, maybe that's looking at the Republican attitude towards immigration is, oh, yeah, okay, of course the country is founded on immigrants. So if you come here and you are just American through and through and want to fight for your country, then that's cool. But if you come here still speaking your crazy foreign tongues and trying to keep your foreign ways and impose diversity on us, then screw that.
Yeah.
You better just speak English and become a Christian.
But speaking of Christian, this, you know, I just wanted to mention again this conflict between the Christian morality that Machiavelli essentially ignores, which I think is also, even though it's not called Christian, it's really at the foundation of a lot of what goes on in ethics today. It's focused on rights and what people deserve or what we ought to do, as opposed to the more pagan concepts of virtue and greatness and the primacy of the political. So it's a question of, when you're thinking about the ethical, do you put the political first, or do you think about rights and those sorts of things as primary? Because if you do put Christian morality as the sort of primary thing, then for someone like Machiavelli, you would never get to the kind of political order which would allow men to thrive, you know?
It's the end justifies the means. He explicitly says that.
What's the end? What's the desired end?
The end is creation of a stable state in which people can thrive.
Yes. So the end is the stability and longevity of the state.
Yes. And if you have to kill a bunch of people to do that, that's all right.
And I think he says...
It's not our place to judge you.
No, but he, I think he says... I think he says
that
if you continue to kill people... you're not likely to contribute to the stability and longevity of the state.
Again, if a lot of these things are tips of how to react to specific circumstances, then you could see, for instance, against Stalin, trying to, okay, I'm going to be very Machiavellian and I'm going to take out all the opposition. Okay, it would be great if the opposition was actually gone. But, oh no, there's still opposition there. I have to take out some more. You know, so what do you do if the piece of advice does not apply in your specific situation? Do you get more and more extreme about it? Oh. I see these people as frustrated students of Machiavelli. They really tried to live up.
I don't know.
But things just weren't working out.
I think they're just sociopaths. What do you guys think of this? Are states inevitably founded upon actions that in our daily lives we consider morally reprehensible?
Yeah, war is killing somebody. So yes, the United States, the Revolutionary War, killing those British people, the Civil War to keep our nation the way it is, those were bad.
I think there are probably very, very few states, that exist that were not founded upon, I wouldn't say morally reprehensible, but not founded upon violence of some sort.
Taking out the Indians. I was about to say, oh, Utah is an exception, but then I'm...
No, I'm saying...
Any given one of the United States was founded... It was only possible from slaughtering all those people.
I mean, just think, you might make an argument that in the transition, some places where there might have been peaceful transition from colonial power, but the colonial powers like established the boundaries of what that state was, and there was violence. It's just they leave and create a vacuum. Name some place where people got together in a federated group and were like, you know what? Here's this piece of land that nobody lives on, and we're all just going to get together and mutually come up with this system of government and then have tea and crumpets.
Disneyland.
Isn't that...
just maybe...
Isn't that...
I don't know.
Canada? I was going to... I don't know. I really don't want to be disrespectful to the native Canadian tribes that were probably slaughtered and dispossessed in the same way the American Native American tribes were, but
well,
I don't know. I don't hear about that story.
Now, the Canadians... The Canadians... They had their wars also with us and with
but also it was a staging ground for wars between the British and the French. In fact, the Cajuns down in Louisiana are descendants of the Acadians, who were Canadians who tried to stay neutral during the war between the French and the British. This reminds me of Machiavelli. Neutrality is not a good strategy. So they were treated badly by both sides, and they essentially had to emigrate en masse, and they ended up in New Orleans.
Well, if Canada was so warlike, then why did Wolverine and his brother have to come down and fight in all the American wars? I just saw that Wolverine movie a couple
what, Red
ago.
Dawn?
No, Wolverine Origins.
What?
Not the Wolverines, not the Red Dawn Wolverines. He's talking about Wolverine, the X-Men character.
Hugh Jackman.
Oh. He's Canadian?
That's revealed in the Canadian wilderness. But he's born there, and then he goes there later in the movie to retire. Actually, it's only like 15 minutes into the movie, but apparently came to the U.S. to fight in World War I and World War II and Korea and Vietnam.
I guess Wolverine was invented by a Canadian. That's pretty far-fetched. I have some Canadian friends here that I like to make fun of all the time.
To your point, Mark, about if you were going to educate our youth about political theory, you'd be better served having them read any number of other writers rather than this. But this is so easy to read, and it's so entertaining. It's kind of like the 400-year-old written version of Fight Club, right? Where it's just like, you read this, and you're just kind of like, yeah, man, yeah, fuck it, yeah. You know, we should just like, social conventions, dude, you know, like, but you get all feisty about how wrapped up in
that. That's why they have high school students read this.
I'm just saying, you could have them read this, or like Adam Smith, right, on The Wealth of Nations. Which one do you think they're going to make it through? One clearly has much more utility than the other, and it's much more still topical and useful.
But also, don't you think, isn't it a useful antidote to the idealism of a lot of ethics and political philosophy? When I read some of these people, I just want to say, how fucking naive are you? People don't work like that. It's important in that sense, this sort of, again, the recognition of the fundamental dilemma. Most people want to talk about social contracts and, hey, speaking of tea and crumpets, let's get together and have tea and write out the Constitution and there's little acknowledgement, again, of the violence that goes into creation of the civil order. Here someone comes and just says, is willing to talk about what no one else will acknowledge.
I agree. And it certainly provokes conversation. Even if we can't find quote-unquote philosophy in here, it's certainly fun to read, and it does stimulate conversation, and it's just so bald, without even justifying itself, it's just so bald a statement.
And it's
it's a bit titillating.
Yeah, it's like watching The Godfather, you know, getting into that.
Totally. It is totally, this is an extended version of that scene where he says, this one time, you can ask me about my business. Except that he's actually, now there's a good prince.
Yeah.
Michael Corleone, because he even pretends, he lies to her. He lies to his wife. He shows the appearance of propriety. He never is neutral, always takes a stand, and has no qualms about eliminating disturbances to the family order and not allowing stronger powers fight his battles for him. There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'm sure that thesis has been written too. There's an ABD out there.
Gangs of New York and Machiavelli. Within a state, there are these little neighborhood fiefdoms, and at a microcosmic level, the stuff still goes on even within a state. Maybe it's operational in some sense socially, not people killing each other, but adolescent groups establishing a leader and cutting another group off, cliques and conflict.
So has there been a video game based specifically on following the guidelines of the prince? Sim Kingdom.
There is a series of games from Firaxis Games, Sid Meier's, called Sid Meier's Civilization.
The Civilization, oh, yeah. Okay. Yep.
You certainly have the freedom to implement a Machiavellian style leadership in that game.
Is it just against other countries or internally?
It's both, right? It's grow your state and...
You can implement your own forms of government. You can implement different types of economic policies, and you can have more or fewer scientists. You can put more guards in the state. You can... You have the ability to control production and management of your state at the micro level. You can basically do whatever you want. But in order to establish your state, you do essentially have to establish it in violence.
There you go. That is a practical thing that our listeners could take away from this. If you go play whatever the most current version of Civilization is, perhaps online against other people, you can name your character Machiavellian Badass and institute these things yourselves.
And you won't have to build any fortresses.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that would work out so well.
All right.
Next episode, we're going to talk about Hegel, one of the most painful writers in philosophy ever. But we're going to read the introduction to his philosophy of history. And this is actually just something taken from his lectures. It was published posthumously. So because he's talking aloud to people, he can't be quite such an opaque, unbearable asshole as he normally is in his harder works. This is, again, somebody who spent a whole semester by choice doing an independent study on Hegel's Phenomenology, which is his first and coolest, most badass work. And this philosophy of history is from very late in his career. So that's next time. Folks should go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to look for a link to that reading. Go participate by responding to posts on our blog, which has ever more posts in it not directly related to episodes. And we also have a Facebook group, which is yet another way that people can give us feedback, can participate in discussions, some of which have been initiated by our listeners. It makes us happy when our listeners, well, let's not say fans, our polite listeners, talk to each other on such forums and not just ask us questions and we respond to them and thank them. So get in there.
So I should like to say this. We are recording, at the time we are recording this, the quote-unquote holiday season has come and gone for us here, at least in the United States. I think we recorded after Hanukkah or during Hanukkah, the last one, but then we've Christmas and New Year's. So I would wish to all of the listeners out there, even though I understand the concept of time as it applies to the way people listen to podcasts now is completely distorted, a happy and prosperous holiday and New Year season. And for those for those of you listening in Southeast Asia and China, best wishes for your future New Year, which is coming up here shortly, I suppose. And
hey, you know, I forgot to ask you guys, because you're saying such inspirational things. Is this your inspirational speech? Do you have an inspirational speech for us?
I do not, but I plan on having an inspirational speech.
I don't have one.
I'll tell you what, maybe I'll add my inspirational speech from that I gave with Dylan there last time to the end of this episode.
What follows is Mark's inspirational speech. Enjoy.
All right. As we were fast forwarding through Biggest Loser, or Kim was, and I was vaguely aware of what was going on, the premise for a whole episode of this is a popular weight loss show in the US for you UK listeners or people in French Guiana or wherever you are. I'm sure they're still watching it anyway.
I heard we had a huge following.
The citizens, yes. So the premise of this, which just seemed to be a freakishly pretentious or weird or something premise, was all the contestants, your task this week is to write an inspirational speech so you can go around saying how awesome you are and urging other people that they can lose weight too or whatever. And okay, I don't deny that it is cool to see somebody who is 350 pounds like down to 180 and feeling healthy and not suicidal anymore. So that's all fine and good. But then immediately like, well, hell, if they're cool enough to write those, then we should have to write those too, because we're following the premise that once you have a little bit of power or notoriety or even an outlet like this, you should immediately make it go to your head far more than it should immediately. So anyway, I felt we should all come up with our inspirational speeches so we can teach the youngins, all the children that listen to this show. Okay, here's the speech. What you see before you, i.e. me, is admittedly very awesomely partially examined, but I was not always this way. I used to stretch myself to conform to codes of conduct and ideals of being foreign to my nature, like I tried not to swear at all for a bit when I was about 12 until I became very embarrassed about my saying gosh really loudly when punched in gym class. I used to use my girlfriends in college exclusively as a sounding board for my hideous self-reflections, externalizing every little notion across my brain in an attempt to make myself an external clump of the world to pick at like a carrion-hungry buzzard. Why, one time I was caught midway between a watering hole and a big juicy steak, and being unable to decide between them, just stood there contemplating the choice until I starved to death. So I can confidently say that while the unexamined life may not be worth living, the constantly, strenuously, annoyingly examined life sucks. But now, I can read and watch things that are dumb and not feel bad about it. I can put myself out there without being so self-conscious about how I can't actually fit all the caveats I would ideally like to into everything I say. I can, much like the Ramones, create explosive idiotic songs that are not meant to expose the entirety of my psyche, but only to repeat and elaborate a trope in a way that will resonate with and hence extend a mere tiny slice of my emotional life. For I am partially examined, damn it, with enough reflection for me to know the foolishness that is me without so much reflection so as to be unduly bothered by that. But you sad sack sitting out there with being in nothingness under your pillow, you objects of a voyeuristic god that not only sees right through your soul but commands that you do the same, you people that constantly need to talk through all your problems, I know you don't like it. I know that it's hard, but there is hope. I stand before you today as living proof that if you fail to try hard enough, you might just succeed. You too can have a partially examined life with only some of your experience spoiled by excessive reflection and omnipresent irony, with relationships that are only partially built on a narcissistic desire to expand your echo chamber, with some expectations undefined and some options not considered. When you hear about someone living under a bridge, you don't have to imagine yourself what it would be like to live under such a bridge and decide for a second that it would be cool, but then decide no, of course it would not be. When you hear a new band your friend likes, you don't have to then go and listen to everything that band has ever recorded and really wade into the music up to your eyeballs until you have an insider's view and only then dismiss them as actually pretty shitty. When you read a book, you can just read it without stopping to write down your own philosophical musings inspired by the sentence you were just reading, but in fact only tangentially related to it. When someone calls you untalented, you can just say screw off instead of asking follow-up questions and about why the person thinks you're untalented, and when you don't get clear enough answers, make up a lot of answers yourself and then dwell on them for months afterwards. No, I say there is hope. By just mostly giving up and not worrying about it out of sheer disgust with yourself, you can, like me, slowly become a more nearly tolerable person to be around who doesn't drive himself absolutely batshit for no reason. With just a touch of philosophy and just a touch now, and some good old-fashioned elbow grease or some other meaningless cliche that you don't think about enough to edit out of your inspirational speech, you too can, like me, have the partially examined life. Thank you.
Se piangi, amore, io piango con te perché tu fai parte di me. Sorride sempre se tu non vuoi vedermi soffrire mai. Se ridi, amore, io rido perché faccio parte di te. Ricorda sempre quello che fai, sopra il mio volto lo rivedrai. Sarai solo, se tu tu sei lontano da me. Ogni momento dovunque andrei accanto a te mi rivedrai. Sono con te perché sono parte di te. Ricorda sempre quello che fai.